You're listening to a message delivered at the Fountains, a United Methodist Church in Fountain Hills, Arizona.
The setting for today's story is all about location, location, location. And Jesus asks a question that almost doesn't make any sense being asked anywhere else. Caesarea Philippi, a beautiful setting north of the Sea of Galilee, where the headwaters of the Jordan River, very symbolic for Jews, is literally gushing right out of the side of the mountain. Even today, it has this mystical quality about it, which is probably why it was already the center of the worship of Pan. You can still see the niches carved into the cliffside where figures of various gods would have been placed as part of all kinds of altars. And in Roman times, when this story was set, there would have been multiple temples to Augustus, Zeus, and Pan. So, standing in the midst of all this, the question Jesus asks his disciples, "Who do you say that I am?" takes on a whole different sense. They were standing there surrounded by all these gods and all those options. But once Peter says, you're the Messiah, Jesus charges the disciples to not tell anyone about him, which is pretty common throughout Mark's gospel, and which makes sense considering that Jesus probably wanted to keep doing what he was doing for as long as possible, and going around making a big deal about him would have brought on the end a lot sooner.
Our words of wisdom are from Mark chapter 8, verses 27 through 30. Jesus went on with his disciples to the villages of Caesarea Philippi, and on the way he asked his disciples,
"Who do people say that I am?"
And they answered him, "John the Baptist, and others Elijah, and still others one of the prophets."
He asked them, "But who do you say that I am?" Peter answered him, "You are the Messiah."
And he sternly ordered them not to tell anyone about him.
Hear what the Spirit is saying to the church.
Thanks be to God.
Apocalyptic firebrand, mystical faith healer, political insurrectionist. There are as many images of Jesus as there are theological and political stripes. Walk into the narthex of any number of Protestant churches and you're likely to find the sentimental, blue-eyed, pink-skinned Jesus of artist Warner Salmon, gazing peacefully upon your comings and goings. Enter the neighboring Catholic church and you'll probably find the image of a beaten, bleeding, emaciated man suffering on a cross. From the Gospels to illustrated storybooks to portrayals on film, Jesus has been the subject of considerable spin over the ages. Each tradition and each individual puts their own emphasis on who Jesus was. And theological reasons aside, over the centuries, artists have portrayed Jesus in ways that are comfortable and familiar to them in their time and their place.
It was a Da Vinci painting, Salvatore de Mundo. It was a painting of Jesus, but it's not like Da Vinci even knew what Jesus looked like. He painted it 1,500 years after Jesus walked the earth, so he was just guessing. He's like, I don't know, he's got brown eyes probably? I don't know. He probably just painted someone he knew. You know, back in the day, they're like, people are like, what is that, your nephew Eddie? Da Vinci's like, no, that's Jesus, the savior of the world. Eddie's wearing the same outfit as him. That's a coincidence.
So, it's just a coincidence that the ideal Jesus for many middle-class Americans is a gentle, upstanding, right-thinking, and often somewhat androgynous suburbanite. with good posture. The notion that Jesus might have been a short, dark, Middle Eastern peasant rabble-rouser is so far from many people's capacity to comprehend that all reason is rejected in favor of this gauzy Aryan vision from early childhood. A blonde-haired, blue-eyed Jesus, meek and mild, is such a stalwart icon of Western culture that to suggest anything contrary or corrective to that image is tantamount to heresy. A few years ago, the Discovery Channel used the actual skull of a first century Jew and the latest in forensic technology to reconstruct what Jesus might have actually looked like. The result fomented an outcry from people far and wide, with accusations of revisionism and political correctness run amok. Columnist Kathleen Parker was so upset that she wrote a column embarrassingly fretting about how the Jesus she knew as a child was being replaced by the kind of guy who wouldn't make it through airport security. When Professor and Pastor Dr. Emily Towns was growing up, she had a hunch that there was more to the story than what was being shared in Sunday school. Even as a child, she knew deep down that we can't be just worshiping this guy who was meek and mild. He's got to have some edge to him.
Actually, this probably says a lot about why I'm an atheist. My favorite Bible story growing up was Jesus turning a temple out. I think there was a part of me that had this deep suspicion that this Jesus, that meek and mild I was hearing about, really wasn't the real Jesus. And we hit that Bible story, and I went, I knew it. That story just said to me, you know, it's okay to question. It's okay to, you know, I can say that now. I didn't have this, these words for it then, but it gave me a sense of it's okay to ask questions. It's okay to say stuff is wrong when you know it's wrong. And it's okay to do something about it.
Right.
Yeah, and that was a very important lesson for a little black girl growing up in the South. Because so much of the society was saying, don't question, stay in your place, accept what it is. And I just somehow knew that wasn't right. And that story gave me the right to do that.
The bottom line is that the American portrayal of Jesus as some sort of sweet guy next door is a sentimental misreading of the Bible. Jesus didn't attract everyone far and near. He was a peasant who likely attracted peasants. According to the Gospels, he was radical enough to even make the liberals of his day, the Pharisees, uncomfortable. So, who was Jesus? Well, the first thing you might want to ask is why I keep referring to Jesus in the past tense. Isn't it better to ask, who is Jesus? Well, that all depends. Marcus Borg makes a distinction that's been really helpful to me. He points out that when studying Jesus, it's good to keep the pre- and post-Easter Jesus separate. The pre-Easter Jesus is Jesus as a figure of history. Jesus of Nazareth, a Galilean Jewish peasant, someone who was from a very low social class, the bottom, really. We think of a carpenter as kind of middle class, an artisan. But what that meant in the ancient world was somebody who had been taxed off their land and would do any kind of work to keep from starving. He lived and worked among the desperate, the outcasts, among the people that we today, many in our culture, shun as unclean. People in prison, immigrants, people who never go to church or the right church, or LGBTQ folks. The pre-Easter Jesus was the human being, the mystic, the healer, the storyteller, the prophet who stood up and, as Rabbi Heschel says, interfered with the status quo and paid the price for interfering. The pre-Easter Jesus is simply who the human Jesus was before his death. The post-Easter Jesus is all the things that Jesus became after his death: the Christ, the Messiah, King of Kings, Lord of Lords, true God of true God. All the ideas and phrases theologians have come up with to try and grasp this post-Easter Jesus of Christian experience. For instance, I know it's a shock to many, but Christ is not Jesus' last name. It's a title that literally means the anointed. And there were other Christs, or messiahs, in the Bible, including Cyrus the Persian, an emperor who was declared Mashiach, or Christ, for letting the Jews return to Jerusalem. So part of who the post-Easter Jesus is are the truckload of titles and labels that we have put on him. Matthew Fox has compared the post-Easter Jesus, the resurrected Christ, with a parallel in the Buddhist tradition, where the Buddha was an historical figure whose presence or whose spirit is known in what's called the Buddha nature. He goes on to say, Christianity flies on two wings, the wing of the historical Jesus and the wing of the cosmic Christ. We have to realize they're not identical. I think he's right when he says that theologians and the church have tended to throw Jesus and Christ and Paul into one pot and stir it up into one stew, and the resulting confusion is not very palatable. It makes it hard to talk clearly about who Jesus was, is, or can be for us, the church, and the world. Suffice it to say that the historical Jesus would probably be very surprised at how he has been portrayed over the years. But he shouldn't be. If you take the Gospels seriously, even while he was alive, the disciples couldn't get who he was worked out in their own minds. For me, a whole new world of understanding has been opened up by being clear in my own mind about the difference between the pre-Easter Jesus and the post-Easter Jesus. Why do we have to look at Jesus all these different ways? You're just confusing me. One blogger on the internet wrote, "Any idiot with half a brain can make a convincing case for his Jesus while punching holes in everyone else's." Too true. And the problem is when we start out with the idea that there's got to be only one Jesus. As we touched on last week, there are lots of different ways of interpreting Jesus. Our challenge is facing the reality of what this same blogger pointed out. I could read and evaluate each different perspective, but I have the attention span of a 3-year-old. I'd get tired of thinking and go back to playing with my G.I. Joes. Yep, and that's exactly what happens. People get tired of thinking. And that's exactly why we're really digging into saving Jesus in this series. Who was he? And how do we know what we know? What difference does it make in how we engage with the world? Well then, here's your first foothold. The pre-Easter or historical Jesus gives us a picture of what a human life full of God looks like. I can use that. Then the post-Easter Christ of faith gives us a framework on which to hang our understandings of the Spirit of God at work in our lives today. I can use that too. Jesus asks, "Who do people say that I am?" And there are lots of answers. we need to be reminded that it's up to us, using all the evidence and experience at our disposal, to determine who Jesus was and is for us today. As German mystic Dorothy Soll reminds us, the most important thing to consider, whoever Jesus is that he needs you. That's all there is to it. Without you, he's left hanging, goes up in Dachau's smoke, is sugar and spice in a baker's hands, gets revalued in the next stock market crash. He's consumed and blown away, used up. Without you. Help him. That's what faith is. He can't bring it about. His kingdom couldn't then, couldn't later, can't now. Not at any rate, without you. And that is his irresistible appeal. So, who was Jesus? It's up to you. As Sole says, he needs you. Jesus needs you to stop messing around and letting other people diminish the radical, uncomfortable, status quo-busting troublemaker that Jesus was. Is your understanding of Jesus something that stretches you? Or do you have a Jesus who affirms your inclination to discriminate against minorities or LGBTQ folks, who gleefully compromise the resources of our planet, or who manipulates the impressionable into supporting policies that are against their own self-interest? How convenient that this Jesus affirms all your already held beliefs, prejudices, and narrow worldview. If we're going to be on about saving Jesus, it starts with us. And we have to start with asking, which Jesus? Dom Crossan reminds us that there's really only one gospel in the Bible, and four according tos, according to Matthew, according to Mark, according to Luke, and according to John. Simply put, this Jesus simply has too much meaning to be limited to only one telling or being portrayed in only one way. And that's not even counting our extra-biblical gospels like the Gospel of Thomas. If there was only one story, then fundamentalist Jesus followers would be even more tempted to literalize and venerate those events than they already are. But with at least five according twos, we get a glimpse of the multiple ways to understand who this Jesus was and is. So, when we start out asking, which Jesus, or Jesus who? It makes sense to get comfortable with the idea that we're never going to have a definitive answer. But we need to embrace the idea that the Jesus we have is a composite character from all sorts of sources, some of which intentionally undermine Jesus' radical, real-world message in favor of a diluted, hyper-spiritual figurehead. The work ahead of us is the same question Jesus asked his disciples: who do you say that I am? And in answering, we have to be discerning about where our impressions of Jesus come from, the history and context that have shaped our assumptions, and, working together, teasing out who Jesus was before Christianity messed him up. Knock, knock. Who's there? Jesus. Jesus who? You tell me. Whatever your answer is, remember, he needs you now more than ever. That's all there is to it. Be well.
Thanks for listening to this week's Applying It to Life from the Fountains. For more information or to support this outreach with a donation, visit www.weputlovefirst.org.